This is Craig Brown, and welcome to Passages. Passages is a space to explore Bible passages used for preaching, reflection, and prayer. My hope is that Passages will shine a unique light on text used for preaching at the First Free Methodist Church of Seattle, or for anyone looking to dive deeper into the Bible. Today's passage is Esther chapter 7. Yes, the entire chapter. And it's the basis for the sermon at First Free Methodist Church on April 28, 2024. It's part of our series, The Art of Holy Living. And it's about how we discover the grace of God in everyday experiences. Let's hear the text from Esther chapter 7. I'll be reading from the 2020 revision of the New American Standard Bible. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day also as they drank their wine at the banquet, "What is your request, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your wish? Up to half of the kingdom it shall be done." Then Esther replied, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my request, and my people as my wish. For I have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, killed, and eliminated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have kept silent, because the distress would not be sufficient reason to burden the king." Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? And where is he who would presume to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. The king then got up from his anger and drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they had been drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who stood before the king, said, "Indeed, behold, the wooden gallows standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good in behalf of the king." And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the wooden gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Well, it's quite a colorful story. Esther 7 is the pivotal moment of her story as it's recorded in really one of these kind of closing episodes of Jewish history before a long period of biblical silence when the New Testament opens. You know, Esther is such a unique character and I think has so many lessons to teach us. So let's just look at the first six verses of this passage from Esther chapter 7, and it has to do with Esther's pivotal moment in the story. Now, I need to recap a little bit because we didn't read the first six chapters of Esther to get to where we are today. Now, Esther is a story set after the exile of the Jews. So the Jewish community living in and around Jerusalem was deported or taken into exile by the Babylonian Empire, and specifically the Neo-Babylonian Empire, in three different waves, in 605, 597, and 586 BCE. And thereafter, close to 70 years of exile in Babylon, there was a regime change. The Neo-Babylonian Empire fell to the Persian Empire. The Persians had not a tremendous amount of interest in keeping Jewish exiles in their homeland, so they allowed those who wanted to return to Jerusalem to do so. And you can read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah that tell you about how those exiles returned in wave after wave. But there were many exiles who did not return, and they stayed in Persia. So of these last three kind of historical books, if you will, of the Old Testament, Ezra and Nehemiah tell us the stories that we know about the Jewish return to Jerusalem. Esther and Daniel are the stories of those who were either in exile, in Daniel's case, under the Neo-Babylonians, or Esther, the closing historical book about her exile in Persia and why she chose to stay there. Now, something that you should know about the book of Esther, and it's commonly talked about, but not everyone is aware of it, is that the word God in Hebrew does not appear one time in this book. That means the singular version of the word God, El, the plural version, Elohim, or even the covenant name of God, Yahweh, none of them appear anywhere in this book. There were many Jews who did not return to Jerusalem when the Persian Empire came to power and allowed them to return home, and so many of them stayed there, and Esther would have been one of them. And the king of Persia at the time, you can call him Xerxes or Ahasuerus, either name works, he needs a new wife. And if you want to read about what happened to his first wife, Vashti, you can read the opening chapter of the book of Esther. So the king basically has a beauty contest to decide who his new wife is going to be. And Esther is chosen from among those candidates. Note some of the similarities here to the book of Daniel. You know, if you kind of hold the book of Daniel and the book of Esther together, they tell very different stories, but they do center around singular character. In Daniel's case, how he handled exile. Esther's case, how she handled being a part of the post-exile in Persia. Now, as she's chosen to become one, to be the king's wife, her uncle, his name is Mordecai, he implores her to conceal her Jewish identity from him. He does not want Esther to tell Ahasuerus that she's Jewish. And so she does. She conceals that truth. Now, later, her uncle Mordecai will end up saving the king's life. You can read about that in the chapters right before Esther chapter 7, not when that happens. But the enemy in this story, who emerges really from the very beginning, is the second in command of the Persian Empire. His name is Haman. He's what's called the king's top advisor. And he has hatched a plot for Jewish genocide. He wants to see all of the Jews in Persia killed. And so there's a trick that takes place on Haman's part that you read about in Esther chapter 3. And what he does is he comes to a verbal agreement with the king to enslave the Jewish people in Persia. But that word for enslave also means destruction or genocide. So the king thinks he's agreeing to the enslavement of the Jewish people, but Haman tricks the king into this kind of nuanced word that would give him license to actually kill the Jewish people, not just enslave them. Xerxes, the king, Ahasuerus, he does not know fully what he has done. He's been somewhat duped with a dubious term used for enslavement or murder. Now, there's lots of moving parts here in the story as you follow it along. There's two different banquets. The king is trying to honor a request from Esther to kind of basically give her what she would wish as his queen. Now, at the second of those two banquets, Esther tells Ahasuerus that she wants Haman to join them there. And the story tells us that when it's time for Haman to come to the banquet, two eunuchs go and get him and bring him in. That's not necessarily significant, except that the first queen, Vashti, she was brought before the king's presence by two eunuchs as well. So the writer's kind of alluding to some similarities between what happened to Vashti and what is going to happen to Haman. So now the stage is set. We're ready for Esther chapter 7. As Esther chapter 7 opens, the king, Haman, the one who's seeking to murder the Jewish people, and Esther, whom no one in the rooms knows is Jewish, they're all drinking wine together. And to be honest, they're getting a little bit sloshed. And in the middle of that conversation, the king asks Esther what she wanted as her request. Now, up until now, Haman's evil plot to destroy the Jews, and especially Esther's uncle Mordecai, who Haman just hated, is moving right along. He had actually built a gallows for Mordecai's execution that he thought was going to be coming very quickly. The gallows he built were 6 stories tall. Yes, 6 stories, so 60 feet in the air. And keep in mind that the Persians did not execute people by hanging. Our Bible translation, especially the New American Standard, doesn't quite do it justice. It's not a gallows. It's actually a spike. And Mordecai is going to be impaled on it. And so it's pretty graphic how this works out. And just passing trivia for you, this form of execution by impalement on a spike or a stake was picked up by the Greeks and eventually the Romans. And this form of execution is the precursor to crucifixion that would come later by the hands of the Romans. Now, the writer depicts this devolving situation for the Jews as long as Esther conceals her identity. Now, it contrasts with Daniel, because Daniel, the moment he was taken captive by King Nebuchadnezzar of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, he confessed his Jewish identity right up front, to the point that he refused to even eat the food the king gave him. So Daniel, from the get-go, acknowledges his Jewish identity, whereas Esther conceals it. And the longer it's concealed in the story, the worse things get for the Jewish people. So finally, the king asks her, "What's your wish?" And she says, "If I have found favor in your sight," is what she says at the beginning. Now, this is important because with the Persian kings, the way they were addressed was always in the third person. So they would never use the second person or first person in addressing them. They would always use the third person. So even if you're standing in front of the king, you would say, "I would request that the king do this." And instead she says, "If I have found favor in your sight." She uses the first person pronoun for herself, the second person pronoun for the king. So something is moving here that's a little bit different. It violates all of the protocols that are usually kept with a king. It's a very relational way that Esther chooses to address him in front of Haman. And there's a keen little bit of writing by the author here. She says, "Let my life be given me, that is my petition, and the lives of my people, that is my wish." So she's asking for her life to be spared and for her people's life to be spared. So you can understand how Ahasuerus is completely confused. What in the world is Esther talking about? She asks for the salvation of the Jewish people from the edict that has been issued by the king for their, what he thought was their enslavement, but what Haman intended to be their execution. And so Esther is asking for her own life and for the life of the Jewish people, and thus she identifies herself as being Jewish in that very moment. She's trying to tell the king he's been tricked without embarrassing him. So she tells him that my people are to be destroyed, killed, and eliminated. That's the edict that Haman has written by tricking the king into this ambiguous word for enslavement or destroyed, killed, and eliminated. And then she even explains further, if it were just a matter of slavery, she would have kept quiet. But genocide, now that is, of course, a different thing. The king asks, "Who is this that's done this, and where is he? Who would do such a thing?" Because, see, the king's anger isn't just about the fact that this edict that he has created, unbeknownst to him, would require Esther to be killed along with all the Jewish people. He's angry about that, but he's also angry about the fact that he's just been tricked, period. So he wants to know who would do this thing. And so immediately Esther points the finger at Haman, who's there drinking wine with them. And she says, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Well, after a long setup, this is an important moment to pause for a key passageway. Truth opens the door for God's healing and justice. Truth opens the door for God's healing and justice. Now, I'll be honest, I'm part of what you could call the minority report on the book of Esther. There's kind of a common understanding of Esther as this triumphant tale of a great hero named Esther who liberates the Jewish people. And for me, part of that is true, but I have a different perspective about how that happens. The Jews, in exile under Persian rule, are in an ever-deteriorating situation. The story gets worse the longer Esther hides her identity. And so as we read the story, Haman's plot to exterminate the Jews gets closer and closer and closer to a reality at every moment of the story. Esther tries to tell the king she's Jewish several times, but her uncle Mordecai keeps telling her not to. And so she's constantly in this battle of identity. She fears the king. She fears Haman. She even fears her own uncle Mordecai. And it's only when she breaks free from all of their shackles, Mordecai included, that the Jews are saved. You know, Esther in the story is a hero only when she breaks free of all the men controlling her. Her truth-telling liberates the Jews. It exposes evil. It advances God's witness. And that's why this key passageway is so important for me. Truth opens the door for God's healing and justice. When there isn't truth, healing and justice find a hard time coming into being because there's not transparency, there's not openness. Truth changes all that. And when Esther tells the truth, when she acknowledges who she is, everything in this story changes. We move quickly to the end of the story here, the graphic ending for Haman in verses 7 to 10 of Esther chapter 7. Well, the king, now having heard this accusation that it's Haman who's been responsible for this plot to exterminate the Jewish people, the king heads to the garden to clear his head. Remember, they've all been drinking a bit too much wine. Now, Haman, instead, he stays in the room with Esther to beg for mercy. And how the story plays out is likely she's reclining on a couch or a lounge of some kind. And Haman, if we understand anything about this Persian culture, he would come kind of groveling at her feet. Well, if her feet are up on the lounge, he is in a sense kind of looking like he's climbing onto the couch or the lounge with her to maybe assault her in some way. So when the king returns into the room, instead of seeing Haman groveling at her feet, he believes that Haman is actually trying to attack her. And so Haman is now accused of a crime that he didn't actually commit. And this is the rich irony of the story, because Haman has accused the Jews of crimes they didn't commit. And so now Haman, who is really in some ways, how could we put it, the progenitor of anti-Semitism, is here on the stage being accused for a crime he actually didn't commit. He's accused of attacking the queen. And the reason this is important is because it gives the king an out. Because now the king has a good reason to arrest Haman. It's not because the king was duped by him, which would be an embarrassment to Ahasuerus. He can simply have Haman arrested for assaulting the queen, which he wasn't doing, but at least the king saw that he was. So the king's able to save face by this. And so one of the eunuchs that's there says, "By the way, you may not know that Haman has prepared a pike for Mordecai to be executed on. So what do we do with Haman?" And so the king in this book, he makes actually his first decree in the entire book. And his first decree is that Haman is to be impaled on the pike meant for Mordecai. It's a brutal end for Haman, but it is a glorious ending in that his plot to kill the Jewish people has been thwarted. And that's a final key passageway for us. Evil is always judged. Now, in the case of this story, Haman is evil. He's evil because he is seeking Jewish genocide. I think we could probably all agree any individual who is seeking the genocide of any group of people is an embodiment of evil. Now, while judgment is elusive for evil. Sometimes it seems like evil gets away with it. But what we claim in the story of Esther, and we also claim throughout the Christian scripture in the New Testament, that the judgment of evil is certainly clear. And notice how the story ends. Haman dies in this story. You know, part of our struggle is to remember that no evil escaped God's judgment, whether it was our own evil or the evil of others. But we can be certain that God will bring judgment, but perhaps at a time and in a way not of our choosing. I find it interesting that in this story, Esther is oftentimes popularized as a children's story. It is so even within the Jewish community today. There's a whole feast organized around this story. Of course, the Feast of Purim, which features children engaging in the story prominently, and there's dancing and celebration. But what is this story really about? It's about evil. It's about genocide. It's about betrayal. It's about power. It's about death. These are all present in here in this story. So trusting in God's judgment is difficult. And that's the odyssey that Esther is in, is whether or not she will trust that God will provide for her when she confesses her Jewish identity, and that the judgment that Haman is due will actually come to him. This trust that she finally finds a way to trust in, this trust that she finally finds a way to put in God, helps us to live in a way that frees us to do the same. Judgment belongs to God. Our work is to proclaim the truth, like Esther, and expose and resist evil when it appears. If you have comments or reflections, I encourage you to visit my website, revcraig.com. Click on News in the upper right-hand portion, and you'll see a drop-down menu where it says Podcast. Click on that, and then click on this week's episode and leave a comment. I also encourage you to visit our church's website at ffmc.org to learn more about Free Methodism and how you can connect with our community. For now, I bid you all grace. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.